what's for the
Do we have a quorum?
Yeah, this is the middle ground.
Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 2nd. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. We have a very busy agenda today, and we are going to begin with Senator Cohen's bill, Residential Hospice Facility Definition Modifications. Welcome to the committee. Senator Cohen, we have a quorum.
So, Madam Chairman and members, thank you very much for allowing me to present Senate File 542, a relatively simple bill and what we call a local bill, but an unusual one. I have with me Mr. Joe Stanislav, and he is the president and the CEO of the Franciscan Health Community, which is a nursing facility in my district on St. Anthony Avenue. And the request is, I hope, Madam Chair and members, a relatively simple one. But within the nursing home, the home is operated for 74 years, what's called the Our Lady of Peace Hospice Agency. And they have provided totally free hospice care, totally free, without a cost to the state or any local government for hospice care for individuals. And they have, over the course of the year, somewhere around 200 and 250 people who utilize hospice care, obviously end-of-the-life hospice care. And under current state law, as I understand it, to be allowed to operate a hospice facility in such a fashion, there, I believe, is a 12-bed limit. This legislation would authorize a 21-bed limit, which is the number of beds that they've been operating at. And the legislation as drafted indicates that they would meet all, the other hospice regulations, except would allow for the 21 hospice patient bed facility. Would again emphasize that this is done at no cost. They're providing this care free without any other state, local Medicare or any other kind of cost. Mr. Stanislav can offer more detail for a couple of minutes about the facility, what they've done, and the very unusual service they've provided.
Thank you.
Mr. Stanislav, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. Just quickly, I think I did pass out a sheet, or a sheet should have been circulated, with some of the main points of our home. Some of the things that we think make it unique and why this exception should be granted. Again, as Senator Cohen mentioned, it has provided totally free care for its total existence since Pearl Harbor Day. It's never charged any member of any patient for the care that's been provided or their families. And we hope to continue that into the long future. The other, I think, key aspects beyond that are that the average lengths of stay for the home are very, very short, much more like a hospice than a nursing home. Right now, our average patient is actually less than 2 weeks in the home. So for many, many years, we were cancer only. For the last year, we have added other diagnoses, but all of them are at the end of life. And so that's been our mission. It's totally end-of-life care. So we're requesting this exception to the 12-bed limit because, well, again, we're 21 beds, so we're barely over it. The home itself pre-existed before all these regulations were written. The good sisters back in those days, I don't think they took it upon themselves to try to get an exception at that point. And now we find that we would like the home to become Medicare certified, which would create obviously more regulations for the home, most of those being at life safety, which would be actually better for our patients. But it also would allow hospices to admit patients to the home who could then use their Medicare benefit in the home. So the home itself cannot bill Medicare, but other hospices. Right now we get a lot of area hospices to admit to the home. Usually they admit to the home when their patients run out of money and they have nowhere else to go. So Our Lady of Peace takes those patients and we care for them free. So we do have a support of the Hospice Association of the state, and the health department has said that it would remain neutral on this issue. And I would say the long-term care leading age of Minnesota would support this as well. So again, we ask your help in passing this bill. And we thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Stanislav. Are there any questions for the testifiers? Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, Mr. Stanislav, I just want to make sure this says that it would become Medicare certified to better support the clients, but we would not be talking about picking up these services under Medicaid, so there wouldn't be a fiscal note to our agency. It says here that certification as a skilled nursing facility is not really your mission, and I just want to make sure that's clear for the record.
Yes,
is that
clear.
Correct?
Madam Chair, and Senator Lori, I should have made that clear that there is not a fiscal note attached to the bill for just that reason.
Excellent. Thank you.
And Senator Cohen, can you help me understand why the law currently now restricts it to 12 beds and what that limitation is about and why you need an ability to do this up to 21 beds?
Madam Chair, I can't. Maybe counsel can help me as to the origin. Maybe Mr. Stanislav knows what the origin of the 12-bed authority is.
You know, we've tried to research that ourselves. We had one person say that they believe that when the hospice laws came into effect, it was after the moratorium on nursing home beds, and there was a strong push from the nursing homes to not allow hospices to become large and therefore compete against nursing homes who were part of the moratorium, who could not add beds. That's the only explanation I've heard. I think there may be some who have said, you know, because of the other aspects of the language about being home-like and residential, smaller would be better. I think in our instance, we're kind of a unique situation there, and that's why we've drafted the bill so specific so that it wouldn't apply carte blanche to the whole industry, just to this one unique facility.
And Madam Chair, just,
yes, Senator Cohen.
Just in the context of this particular bill, what's unusual about this is that when the Franciscans set up the nursing home, as Mr. Stanislav indicated, you know, going back, you know, pushing 80 years ago, obviously there was not a state regulatory setup as we now have, where there wasn't the concern there wasn't Medicare, there wasn't Medicaid, there wasn't a lot else going on. And so nobody really paid any attention as such, as I understand the history from what happened originally. And obviously we don't have any of the founders of the home available to us. But as I understand the history of this home, it was just set up as another nursing home. And so there was no nothing to prevent them from at some point kind of converting to having part of the home serve as a hospice home. And as I understand it from, as Mr. Stanislav has indicated, this has been something that predates almost the entirety of the hospice movement as we understand it.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, I definitely understand why this is a good bill. As we continue to see our population aging and the baby boomers, I understand why there's a greater need for hospice care, and there will be going forward. I do have a question for your testifier. Will this allow the Our Lady of Peace then to be eligible for the Medicare hospice benefit?
Mr.
Stanislav.
Thank you. It will allow the home to admit patients who can use their Medicare benefit through another hospice.
Okay.
So the home itself is Medicare certified, but it cannot bill only a hospice.
The hospice service. All
yes.
Right. Thank you very much.
Because, Madam Chair, the intent is still to keep the home as a home for basically people who don't have assets, and would be considered to be on the poor end of the population, but still in need of the service. But with the Franciscans, I'm not sure in terms of funding if it's coming through the Franciscans these days or the Archdiocese, providing the money for the service, basically. So that answers gets back to Senator Laurie's question.
Seeing no further discussion, would Senator Laurie move Senate File 542 be passed and referred to the floor? Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
members.
You, Madam
Thank
Chair
you.
Members.
Next on our agenda is the confirmation of the Department of Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen. Welcome, Commissioner. Hello, Commissioner. I'm just going to make a few comments, and then if you would like to make some comments as well, that would be good, and we'll open it up if there are questions from the committee members. Just for background, in January 2011, Governor Dayton appointed Lucinda Jessen to serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. DHS is the state's largest agency, serving well over 1 million people with an annual budget of $11 billion and more than 6,500 employees throughout the state. The department administers a broad range of services, including health care, economic assistance, mental health and substance abuse prevention and treatment, child welfare services, services for the elderly and people with disabilities. DHS also provides direct care and treatment to over 10,000 clients every year. Commissioner Jessen was confirmed by the Senate in 2013. Prior to joining DHS, Commissioner Jessen served as a law professor and founding director of the Health Law Institute at Hamline University, and has brought to the position of commissioner a deep knowledge of health and human services industry, and has a breadth of legal and management experience in both public and private sectors. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Lucinda Jessen, and for the past 4 years, it's been my privilege to serve as Governor Dayton's administration's Commissioner of Human Services. I want to, first of all, thank a few people. I want to thank the governor for the privilege it's been the last 4 years. I didn't know Governor Dayton until shortly before I started this job, and I've come to know him as a man of principle, someone who truly cares about people, who pays a lot of attention to detail and hard work, and yet keeps the big picture in mind. And it's been a privilege to serve in his cabinet. Do want to thank my husband, should he be listening, for his patience. To thank the employees of the Department of Human Services. I mean, so people say, Cindy, you have a hard job. I'm like, you haven't seen a nurse who's working in a NOCA regional treatment center. You haven't seen a security counselor at Security Hospital. We have just so many good, hardworking employees. And I really want to thank all the county workers, too. It has been such a privilege to get to know and work with the county directors, but especially those county frontline county staff. I think it's harder to get up to speed being a county financial worker and understand all our eligibility rules than it is to be in a high-level kind of policy position. And I want to thank all of you for your support the last 4 years. We didn't agree on everything, and some of us agreed more than others, but you all, I think I've worked with almost every one of you on one issue or another. And, you know, and I think especially in a challenging job, when I was going through some personally challenging times, you all have been so supportive, and I really thank you so much for that. And I have to just thank the people of the state of Minnesota. I mean, if you think about the rankings that, you know, affect what we do, we have ranked as having the number one healthcare system in America, the number one long-term care system, the number one ranked by AARP for home and community-based services, number one healthy estate for seniors, number four for serving vulnerable people, usually in the top five for kids. I mean, that government alone doesn't do that. That's kind of a state that values caring for our children and our seniors and people with disabilities. And I'm just privileged to live here. I do think, this knowing I was going to be talking with you about this today caused me to reflect. And there have been a lot of challenges the last 4 years. I mean, 4 years ago when we dove in, that was in the middle of a recession and really tough economic times and a lot more people turning to our programs who really needed them. And at the same time, we faced this historic budget deficit. And I think in this environment, we couldn't just simply debate what to cut and what to preserve. We had to look at every option for doing things differently and doing things better. That was true 4 years ago, and I think despite a lot better economic times, that's still true today. And that's true because our programs are the safety net that most Minnesotans expect our government to provide. To help, and I'll just tell a few stories. I'm so lucky I get to go around and meet people and kind of see the face of human services. And let me just share a few of the people that stood out to me. This was a 17-year-old I met in an adoption celebration a couple of years ago. He was adopted after many foster care placements, but finally adopted with his two younger siblings by a family in southern Minnesota. And he talked with me about how he's joining the choir at his church and how he never thought he'd be in the kitchen filling out a college application with his mom. But there he was. Or the older couple I visited in Mankato, who were able to stay in their home. They're in their late 80s because we, you know, working with a faith nonprofit in Mankato, are able to provide a chore service and have someone come in and move their washer and dryer upstairs so they didn't have to go down those stairs. Or to the parents and mostly moms who are on our assistance programs, and most of them are really trying to do the best thing for their families but to struggle with paperwork. And I remember talking to a mother who's cringing because she had to go up to a professor every class and get him to sign something saying she was there when she was setting the curve in that class. And the kids that I see in our child care program. Last month I was in Rochester at one of our parent aware rated facilities helping kids make Valentine's. And just seeing what a difference quality child care makes in the lives of those kids. So those are just a few of the million-plus people we serve every year, people who, along with the taxpayers, expect us to do more than just preserve the status quo. So 4 years ago, when we started these reform efforts, we looked first at managed care contracts and reforming those. And why? Well, for one thing, that's where the money was. And they certainly needed reform. And by putting our managed care contracts out for bid, we got a lot of savings. We applied those savings across the state. And we also negotiated caps, a one-year cap at 1%. But we also said, let's have caps moving forward. Let's set expectations that we're going to control these costs. And since then, we've come in under those caps by having more competitive bids, by having good negotiations, and we've saved the state a lot of money in doing that. And I'm all for driving a hard bargain, but we've got to do more than just pay less for basic care and to just really bring reform to our complex system, especially because our state's growing older. We have more and more of our seniors and people with disabilities that will be turning to our Medicaid program if we don't try and do this differently. So just to recap a few things that I think collectively we've worked on. One is our Reform 2020 initiative, which is going to redesign the fastest growing part of our budget, which is home and community-based services for the elderly and people with disabilities. And this didn't happen overnight to get it passed and to get it approved by the federal government, but we're starting to really turn and say, look, if we can have more consumer-driven choices, if we can have more community supports, more interventions during transitions when we know people are harmed, we're going to have a more sustainable long-term care system in the future. But second, I think we've really said, you know, paying less doesn't get us better results. And sometimes paying more doesn't get us better results. And so we have to have better health outcomes, I think, for our dollars. And we're tackling that on a couple of different fronts. And I know most of you are aware of this, but we were the very first state to get approved and to start having direct contracting with providers, which is kind of trying to change the incentives to just doing more in our fee-for-service system to actually trying to keep people healthy and being more efficient. And we showed last year that just our first round, our first year of that, when we just were hopeful people would break even because they're setting up a new system, we saved $10 million. And as of this month, we have 175,000 of our medical assistance enrollees that are receiving care through these providers, and we'll be adding more. And those are providers all around our state. And we're also working a lot more closely with counties to try and integrate kind of our health care and our county social services so we can better serve clients. You know, Hennepin Health is a good early example of this. We're seeing good outcomes for people and for taxpayers. And they're just doing some amazing work in Southern Prairie and southwestern Minnesota as well, that 12-county collaboration. And we're also, I think, trying to do a better job saying, look, let's pay for what the evidence tells us works. So our school-linked mental health grants are a great example of that, which the legislature doubled those so that we're now serving 35,000 kids in over 800 schools today. And In mental health, I'm just proud that while during this recession a lot of states cut back and did less, we stepped forward and started doing more, especially for our kids. But overall, I think we need to still continue to do more. This is such a work in progress to make outcomes and quality hallmark of our purchasing efforts, whether we're talking about purchasing health care or purchasing child care. So some of the places that maybe don't make the headlines where we've seen that happen are nursing home increases that are tied in part to quality. Instituting a system of quality-based increases for home and community-based providers. Quality payments for incentives for child care tied to parent aware ratings. And I think one thing that's going to be, we're just starting now to implement, but it's going to be fundamental, is our county performance council. We're working closely with the counties and saying, in each of these areas, what are the outcomes we should expect from counties? And then if they don't meet the thresholds for those, and we're starting to measure those and sending out things even just last month, if you don't, you know, then there are consequences. There's performance plans, and ultimately, if a county doesn't come into performance, you know, there's the ability to shift those services elsewhere. This is something we really are working closely with the counties on, I think has the potential for making a big difference. So knowing I'd be here, as I was saying, it gave me a chance to think about some of the things I was proud of. I've mentioned some of them. I mentioned a few more. But then I also just want to mention some areas where that reasons I want to stay, if you confirm me. Because there's a lot more work to be done. So I'm proud that more Minnesotans have health insurance. Not all the ACA work, but boy, we made Medicaid expansion work here in Minnesota. I'm proud of that. We have more kids in quality child care. I'm really proud of that. We have more people who are eligible for SNAP who are actually on SNAP, especially seniors. We had about 30% of our seniors were eligible for SNAP. We're on it now. We're about 50%. And that's because we made it easier for seniors and did more outreach. We have more people who are on SNAP who are getting healthy food. Great work working with like Blue Cross and a lot of other partners around, you know, making sure that we have health SNAP benefits at our farmers markets. I was just meeting with Second Harvest. They told me now that 49% of the food they distribute is healthy, fresh food. That's a real difference. We have more adoptions from foster care of our most vulnerable children. And I'm really proud of the work we did together around North Star. And we have more people moving out of Anoka and Security Hospital and headed to the community in a safe and appropriate way. I'm proud of that. Bonding for a new security hospital, I'm just delighted that we are able to accomplish that. And we have, and this is kind of internal stuff, but beefed up internal audits and more fraud detection and prevention, a new child care assistance fraud unit, and we're seeing real results of those efforts. We have more people served in the community. Nearly 2,000 seniors and people with disabilities have moved from institutions back in the community where they want to be, and that's great. And we've improved safety for infants, at least made steps in that direction with our new safe sleep legislation, as well as our improved safe place for newborns. But as I said, we have work to do, and that's why I'm here, hoping that you all recommend my confirmation. I mean, sure. We need to press forward and make these IT systems work, especially for the 90% of people who are going through it, which are public program enrollees. And I must say, I was troubled when I heard on the radio last week a Minture board member saying it's public programs that are dragging Minture down. I believe that it's our county and state workers who are doing these workarounds that are helping it be in the place it is today. And we need to make the system work better for those workers and for our enrollees. And while we spend a lot more than almost any other state per capita on people with disabilities on our waiver programs, we need to step back and say, are we really improving people's lives? We've got to make the system less complex, and we've got to start measuring and looking at those quality outcomes for people. And that is very important. We're trying to do that with Olmstead, but I just think we have to take a whole new fresh look at this. And it's not because we're not spending dollars on this. In the past 4 years, we've seen some improvements in our kids in foster care through North Star and trying to get children into permanent homes. But, boy, we have a lot of work. And, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you serve on the task force, and you know this, for what happens to children in our child protection system before they get to court. And that's got to be a focus of ours. And it's not something that's going to be solved by March 30th or next year. It's a multi-year project. But it's so important to all of us. And we've got to look at foster care as well because we don't have enough providers. We need more oversight there. we have, despite our progress, a fragile mental health system. Too many people having to drive and wait to get access to services they need and housing and supports that they need. A couple more things. Direct care and treatment. We've made some real progress as far as person-centered care and reducing the use of seclusion and restraints, but we have a lot of work to do in our direct care and treatment part of the agency. And we got to start figuring out, and that's what we're trying to do, and maybe we didn't do it as well as we can, but we're trying to start the conversation of what should the state be doing and what should the private sector be doing. We need to be there for people that the private sector won't serve, and a lot of those with public safety risks. But then we need to figure out where the private sector can step up and where that's appropriate. Addiction. We have just too many addicted babies that are born. We've seen a doubling of those in the last just the last few years. And a rise in heroin, meth again, and opioids. I've been trying, as I think some of you all know, to bring together this statewide group to have a statewide look at what we're going to do around substance abuse. And we've had, just looking at Senator Eaton, some successes. But we have a lot of work to do. And I think sometimes it's hard just to come to grips that we have a state that, like every other state, but here too, that's struggling with addiction. And so I think we have some real opportunities for improvement there. And finally, I just say we just need to continue to work on the challenge of teenage moms. I think one of those figures that when I first heard that, I know I've probably shared this before, that was most troubling to me is that 75% of teenage moms in our public programs, their moms were on there. So we have to have like a two-child approach to this. And that's why I think that quality child care is so important. Get those kids into quality child care, let their moms be able to finish school and work and try and address both of those. And that means helping with parenting. That means helping with the CD issues because both of those are critical. So these are all the reasons I want to stay, make more progress together with all of you. But it has been a privilege. It's been the most challenging job I've ever had. It's been the best job I've ever had. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the reminder of all the work that we've done in the past and the work that lies ahead. And I just wanted to personally say how much I've appreciated your leadership over the last 4 years and do look forward to you carrying on in the role that you've played so well. It has been full of some challenges. We haven't always agreed on everything, but I just really appreciate your very personal approach and your willingness to come and work with me personally and with the legislature when we reach out and have issues to work through. And I think that really serves the people of Minnesota well when we can have those really good relationships. And you said most of it very well, and what really came through to me was your commitment to the people we serve with some of your really incredible stories. And so I'll just leave it at that, and I'm in full support of approving your appointment and hope that we can do so quickly.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I, too, appreciate all the work that you've done. If you members, if you had a chance to look at her appointments and positions and where she's done her education, her honors, it's very impressive sheet that you have here. More impressive is I do believe, and I do tout you as the hardest working commissioner out there. And I had the pleasure of having her down in my district last Tuesday, on a field trip. That's what I called it. So I had the commissioner in my car with no radio on, and that's good. It's a good thing. So my question to you, though, Commissioner, is what are some of your top priorities? You mentioned some of the things that need to be worked on, but I would like to know 1, 2, and 3 of issues that are pressing for you and the department.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it's hard to come up with just three, but I do think we need to do a better job taking care of our children. You know, and that's, you know, some in the mental health camp, that's some in the child protection camp, I think that will be a some in the child care camp. But we have too many children living in deep poverty, and a number of them end up sometimes in our child welfare system. So we've really got to tackle that. Second, I think our mental health system and kind of that kind of blends over some to our substance abuse and addiction systems, they are too fragile. And we've done a lot of work on the traditional healthcare side. We really need to focus on mental health and substance abuse. And then three, we have to, moving forward, continue to work on and fix MNsure. And that's having an IT system that works for our county and state is just critical to our future of being able to run these programs going forward. And, you know, we just I'm very committed to doing whatever it takes to do that.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I want to say thank you sincerely. We have been on the opposite side of many issues, but you make the effort to reach out. You make time to have in-depth conversations about where we can agree the state should go. And I think that's a hallmark of somebody who can work across the aisle, focused on actual solutions, and wants to solve problems going forward. And so I am happy to support your confirmations.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to support your confirmation, too. I wanted to get to one of the things you said in response to priorities, and not a question or anything, but just there was a very nice commentary, I think this weekend in one of the papers, about how MFIP grants haven't been increased for like 28 years, and I think you mentioned a minute ago all the kids who are in poverty and the issues they face. I just want to keep that. That was part of your one of your priorities, I think, but I think we got to mention that as well, just so. Next 4 years, we hope we can move forward on that. So thanks.
Senator Nelson, we'll start with Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I will be glad to support you in your quest for a second round of confirmation here. I think you've done a great job. I personally have appreciated the way that you work with the legislators and actually spend time with us talking about issues that are important to us. And then actually, I greatly appreciate your support on those issues. And I know you've testified before in favor of some of my bills, particularly the high-quality child care. And I just appreciate the fact that that you do work so hard and that you're looking for solutions. And I personally appreciate your priorities, too. Children and strengthening, I do believe our mental health system is extremely fragile, and it is critical that we have more success in that area. So I greatly appreciate your priorities there as well.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to thank you. We've worked on a number of issues together, and I've always appreciated the fact that you've been accessible and willing to listen. I did want to make a pitch for the people who are often not, they're not the ones that everybody thinks is fun to advocate for, and they're the people with serious and persistent mental illness who are in acute state of their illness at Anoka Treatment Center or the other state facility. They're in a place that they don't want to be. Their illness is out of control. They've ended up in corrections or whatever. They need that kind of security to be safe and to get their treatment, but yet even usually NAMI doesn't like them being there, and they burned out their families and their communities. And the only people they have advocating for them generally are the staff that work there who are very, very dedicated. And I just want to remind, you know, it's not like taking care of the nice little kids. These are people who aren't all that pleasant sometimes because they're very ill, but they do need our support.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Thank you so much for coming over today. We do appreciate you, and much like most of the committee, I'm going to continue to support you. We have kind of wrestled round and round on particular issues, but in a way that I think was respectful and frank and honest, which I think is really important to do. I also just want to give a pitch along with Senator Marty about these folks we talk about who are on our public assistance programs, our MFIP participants and others. I think that we do need to really continue to focus there. We do need to kind of continue and figure out how do we stop this unfortunate, what is now a legacy of being in poverty, continue to be in poverty, grandmothers, mothers, and now they're having children. I think the early childhood and having it to be quality child care. I think we need to do a lot of work on that to ensure that we have the right balance, and I want to continue to work with you on that issue. But in addition, I think that we still have this issue of disparities in our system, and when you look at who is on our public programs and the duration that they stay on, they unfortunately tend to be people of color. So I would hope that we would continue a focus. We have done some work over the last 4 years. We have great committees and some great leadership on that issue, but I would hope that we would do that so we can continue to move the dial on you working, your office working with Dr. Ellinger's folks at MDH, I would hope that we can continue to collaborate closely together so that we can, so that everybody in Minnesota can feel this prosperity that we're all feeling today. So thank you for your work, and I'm hoping to continue to work with you on those issues.
Thank you, and I'd like to add my voice of admiration for the work that you've been doing. It's been really, really impressive to be able to work with you and how calm and thoughtful you remain in the height of some very contentious and difficult conversations. I think that characteristic and quality that goes along with the intelligence that you bring to this and problem-solving capacity is phenomenal, and we're lucky really to have you in this position. I appreciate your perspective talking about, you know, poverty is just an enormous contributor to many of the problems that we are then having to expend resources to deal with the complex problems that occur in various communities as a result of poverty. So, you know, initiatives and policymaking that try to turn those drivers of the problems that we're always fixing is a theme that I hear from you always, without losing track of the importance of investing in intervention when there is crisis, whether it's in mental illness or the current theme that we're working hard on right now, which is intervening on the behalf of children when the environment that they're in right now, for whatever reasons, is problematic and that the child needs protection. So I thank you for that. And I also want to add that this is a huge administrative job. Not only are we talking about public policy, but, you know, when you think about $11 billion that you're head of an agency that is really engaging the expenditures of $11 billion in 6,500 employees. So your job is not only about giving us a vision and a sense of direction, following the data and laying out how we can improve healthcare delivery systems, the healthcare of the people in the state, the welfare of the people who live here, but it's administering this whole enormous, enormous agency. And that just is really mind-blowing in relationship to the size and the complexity of the agency that you head and lead. So thank you for that. Thank you for that. Thank you for being willing to do it in the first place, especially with the expertise and the many options and choices you would have in your life for how to spend your time other than serving in this position.
Yeah.
Is there anything further?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, just out of curiosity, and I do find it interesting that you try to get out into throughout the state. What did you like about last week and your little field trip, besides being with me? How I kind of...
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it's always good to be with Senator Rosen. She knows that I drink Diet Coke. She brings them to me. It's like, it drives me around. It was great. You know, I learned so many things. Like when we were visiting a really good treatment facility for women in, I'm trying to remember the name of the town.
Garden City.
In Garden City. And we, of course, need, one of our great needs in our state is facilities that can treat women with their children and pregnant women. Which kind of gets to the addiction issues. One of the things that I it was just like a model I'd like to be able to do more of in our state. So I've been thinking about how to do that. But also, one of the things that really drove home to me is if you're really going to help these women and their children, you need to not only be talking about their addiction, we need to teach them how to parent. And they were talking about some of the obstacles and hurdles. We don't make it easy to pay for parenting, teaching parenting, but that's so important. If they take, you know, deal with their addiction, but they don't learn how to parent, we end up with many of those children back in the same places. And so that was just like one insight, that those aha moments that I don't think I get sitting at my desk, even talking to really the smartest people in St. Paul. So that was one example.
Thank you. I think we need to close this down. We do have three more bills to try to get through before the end of the session. So, Senator Rosen.
Oh, just a comment. I just find it fascinating that she does come out into throughout the state, and it's similar to us. We're here, and not until you get back into your district that you go, oh, yes, that's why I ran for office. I do love this job because you can make an effort. And so this Senator is why Benson. We've been able to keep her for 4 years plus.
Senator Benson. And,
Madam Chair, I just advised the Commissioner, Senator Rosen, asked you to go on an ag tour to get some good details. You can ask her
about
that.
Okay, so Senator Lori moves that this committee recommend the appointment of Lucinda Jessen as Commissioner of the Department of Human Services be confirmed. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed? Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you all so much.
Senator Hayden, Senate File 643, Low-Income Uninsured Adults and Children Health Program Establishment.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. I have Senate File 643. 643 fills the gaps in Minnesota's safety net for low-income Minnesotans who do not have health insurance. We've made great progress in Minnesota in making health insurance more affordable and accessible for people who could not get coverage before, but there's still gaps. Lack of access to health care coverage results in poor health and higher health care costs, as treatment is either delayed or provided in the most costly setting. This also creates significant burdens on the safety net clinics, hospitals, and providers who agree to provide free or reduced cost care to uninsured patients bear disproportionate burden of the cost of caring for the uninsured Minnesotans. Senate File 643 fills two gaps by providing coverage for low-income children who are not eligible for any other state programs or subsidies, and by establishing a chronic care program for uninsured children and adults who have serious ongoing chronic conditions who are unable to obtain services they need. Today I have Michael Scandrett from the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, and I'm not sure if Ann Quincy is here from Legal Aid, who supports this bill to provide more information about uninsured and how this program will help fill these gaps.
Thank you, Mr. Scandrett.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net Coalition. The coalition's members are healthcare providers whose primary mission is serving low-income, diverse, and disadvantaged populations located across the state and representing the full spectrum of healthcare, including mental health, primary care, dental services, and hospital and specialty care. Obviously, the members of the Safety Net Coalition serve a lot of patients who are currently uninsured. In fact, probably the primary place that many people would go to receive their care. And so the issue of insurance for the remaining uninsured is very important to our members and to those communities, and especially to those patients who don't have the coverage. Even though the Affordable Care Act and past work that the state has done and the legislature has done has significantly reduced the number of uninsured Minnesotans, the rate of decline in the uninsured has been much smaller for the safety net providers. What happens is people who get insurance will then sometimes go to other providers when they have the coverage. And other patients who may be referred by those other providers because they don't want to provide the free care would end up back at the safety net providers again. So I think this committee is well aware that there have been many studies that have shown that the lack of health insurance has serious consequences for patients. Generally, the uninsured have poorer health. They don't access primary and preventive care. They tend to delay treatment until their problems get much worse and that are more difficult and costly to treat. And they are more inclined to use the emergency room when they do receive care. Without the basic coverage, people, by delaying care and not accessing services, There's a lot of untreated and unmanaged chronic conditions out there that will eventually get worse and will eventually end up in the need for care. And when that does happen, again, the burden of providing that care falls primarily on the nonprofit safety net providers, as well as local governments when they have community hospitals or provide other services to cover the uninsured. So just to get an example of how even though we've made great progress and have fewer uninsured, the problem still remains within the safety net community. The community health centers, for example, the federally qualified health centers, even though the statewide average of uninsured has dropped by 40%, their drop in uninsured was only 12%. And last year, even with the expansion of Medicaid and the implementation of the insurer coverage, still 30% of patients overall in the state are uninsured at the community health centers. So there's one program that exists for the uninsured. It's called the Emergency Medical Assistance Program. And what emergency medical assistance does for anybody who's not eligible for any other programs and is low income is it will provide a payment for emergency medical conditions, and primarily if provided in an emergency room or hospital with a few additional expenses. So really we have a program, but it is the kind of program that covers only the most expensive care and doesn't provide payment for those services that would keep people out of the hospital or keep chronic conditions managed. And so there is kind of issues with higher use of the ER, longer stays in the hospital at the expense of the state and federal government because people aren't receiving additional care for their chronic conditions. So Senate File 643 has two components to it. It addresses two problems with the current system. One is uninsured kids. There are still a number of kids who don't have health coverage and are less likely to receive well baby care and preventive services and other care that they need when they're healthy, as well as being able to access affordable care when they do have health conditions. So that first category is the uninsured kids. And the second is the people, the adults who have serious chronic conditions. We talked about how they often end up in emergency medical assistance, but only when their condition becomes an emergency and requires ER and hospital services. So what we would propose to do is provide additional services for those people who do have serious chronic conditions that could be services provided outside of a hospital that would prevent the need for the care, would be alternatives to hospital and ER care. We've done a really great job in Minnesota in other aspects of learning how to manage chronic care effectively for people who do have serious chronic conditions. We've shown that we can reduce hospitalization and ER use for those patients. We don't do that for the people that are uninsured, and we do pay for the consequences in the Emergency Medical Assistance Program. So in addition, that bill gives the Commissioner of Human Services the authority to manage these new programs using our existing healthcare reform models. So again, we're going to do it efficiently. We're going to try to use the cost-effective settings. We're going to try to reduce the use of ER in hospital care and have other incentives and ways of paying for care that would ensure that people receive the most effective services and most cost-effective and keep that total cost of care under control. The second thing it does is ask the commissioner to work with the federal government on the Emergency Medical Assistance Program to see if the federal government might agree to some greater flexibility for Minnesota so that we would get some of that federal match that currently goes for the ER hospital and crisis level services and have some of that federal match available to provide the cost-effective alternative community services. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ann Quincy from Legal Aid to talk a little bit more about the community's perspective. And then I'll answer questions after Ann is finished with her testimony.
I'm going to put my glasses on to check the time. I want to make sure that we have time for the other bills. Yes, we have a few more minutes. If you could highlight, if we understand the essence of the bill, I think the members of the committee may want to use some of the time to ask questions for clarification.
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name's Ann Quincy. I'm a benefits attorney at Minneapolis Legal Aid. For the past 18 years I've been working on government benefits, primarily in the last few years, a lot more medical coverage. Our clients at Legal Aid include families with kids, people with disabilities, single adults, and seniors. Many of our clients are immigrants, and many of those immigrants have critical need for access to quality health care. As part of my work on government benefits in the last 2 years, as the EMA program changed, as Emergency Medical Assistance Program changed from 2011, 2012, and 2013, the state implemented several changes, and the medical assistance program expanded. What we've seen is that there's this growing gap of people who are eligible for services but not finding their way to the right coverage. Senate File 643 would particularly focus in on kids, uninsured kids, some of whom are eligible for federal programs but aren't on them, some of whom would only be eligible for wraparound services with state dollars, as Mr. Scranton described, for their preventive care instead of just focusing on their emergency care. But the proposal would have Minnesota join six other states that cover all kids, regardless of their immigration status. There are federal dollars we could be using to cover these kids. We encounter every month children that we are serving at Legal Aid who we've been able to achieve an immigration status upgrade for them. They've gotten an immigration status, possibly special immigration juvenile status, U visas, and they should be eligible for our medical assistance program, especially under the expansion that Minnesota's been undergoing. And they're having trouble getting in. What this means is that the EMA program is sometimes covering people like citizens that it's not designed to cover, and it's not covering kids that it is supposed to cover. The costs are quite large financially to the state to be spending state dollars when it could be using federal dollars. But also medical. You can imagine a child who's languishing in a hospital when they could be getting good community care, community-based care, a child with severe mental illness who's not getting mental health services. And so by simplifying the program and, as I say, joining other states that are covering children regardless of immigration status, Minnesota would be able to save dollars but also provide much better health care.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions on the bill from the committee? Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, I'm struggling a little bit. There's a slide on page 3. Adults 21 and older, aren't they not already eligible for public programs or subsidies at the federal level?
Mr. Scandrett.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, the primary group of adults that would not be eligible would be people who are either documented immigrants but who don't meet other requirements for eligibility for medical assistance, or undocumented immigrants in that category.
So,
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair. So then we go back to slide 2. And it's the 50% in the green, in the pie chart. The green, is that who we're targeting? What portion of the pie chart here are we covering with this?
Mr. Scandrett?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Benson, yeah, I apologize. It's a little bit confusing. That pie chart shows the total number of uninsured, but that includes people, for example, who choose not to get insurance but could afford it under the eligibility criteria or the affordability criteria for MnSure. It includes people that are in transition as well. So those that we're would be looking at would be a small portion of the green would be in that category, and then in some way or another, most of the people in the children in the blue, 14% undocumented, would be covered. The kids, all kids in that piece of pie would be covered, and some of the adults, but only if they have a serious chronic condition.
And so,
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Scandretti, what percentage of the green? And why just that percentage? They're documented immigrants. They're exempt from the mandate. So what other quality do they have that means they can't get insurance somewhere else?
You mean the people that we're not covering that are in the green?
Right.
Mr. Scandretti?
Madam Chair, get back to my – keeps rifling through the slides. The documented exempt from the mandate would be, for example, someone whose income is low enough that under the rules for the mandate of coverage, they would not be required to get the coverage. But some of those may have incomes above those thresholds that we're creating here, so they wouldn't even be eligible for these programs. So they are exempt from the mandate for various reasons, which could be, for example, the affordability, the cost of available coverage is too high for what they the rules would say they can afford to pay. But that doesn't mean that their income would be low enough to qualify because we have low thresholds for eligibility in these programs.
And Senator Benson.
Madam Chair. Okay. I'm just having a really hard time wrapping my head around numbers. So at some point, I'm just going to want to know numbers. So of the 200,000 uninsured, what number are we going to cover? But I do have a question. Children 21 and under, does that include 19-year-olds, able-bodied?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator Benson, that would include anyone that's below that age who meets the income requirements. The kids program would just, the goal here is to just be able to say to the community, you know, don't delay care or avoid care for your kids. There's going to be some way to cover that care for kids. For adults, again, it's only certain adults who have a very chronic and serious condition that's going to result in an emergency if they do not access care.
Senator Benson.
Okay, so a 19-year-old undocumented shows up here and they get access to health care. Doesn't matter how long they've been here. Doesn't matter if their parents brought them over when they were four. None of that matters. They come here undocumented, they get coverage.
Mr. Scandret.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, this bill proposes that all kids should have access to coverage, regardless of those other factors.
And Madam Chair, maybe we just have a disagreement on what kids are, but at some point, they're not kids anymore. There's, you know, proposals to let people who are 18 years old drink alcohol, let people who are 16 vote, and now we're saying they're children. So, in any case, I'd like to, Madam Chair, ask Mr. Scandret about adverse selection in the adults over 21. If they are eligible for other programs and simply aren't getting them, and they wait till they get sick, how is that addressed?
Mr. Scandret.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, the bill says that this would only cover those individuals or children who are not eligible for any other programs and who have a low enough income that they would qualify, meaning that they probably couldn't afford to buy any insurance that's available to them.
Senator Benson and
Madam
then Senator
Chair,
Nino.
My last question, how many people?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, we're currently working with the Department of Human Services to kind of get down to the precise numbers. It's a little difficult because we're in this state of flux where we don't know exactly how many people are going to end up uninsured after all of the rollout of MnSure and the expansion of Medicaid and so forth. But we're waiting for some numbers from DHS and should have those any day in terms of the numbers in each of the categories.
Senator Nino.
I'm just trying to wrap, like Senator Benson, I'm trying to wrap my head around what groups are we getting at here. So if we had, I'm just looking at adults, not children. If we had an adult 22 years old that's not eligible for the other state programs, but clearly is eligible under the ACA, Obamacare, to go into the exchange and get subsidies, but has opted not to do that, would they be eligible under the language in this bill or not?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Scandrett.
And Senator Nino, they would not. If they're eligible for any other program or to get coverage through MnSure, this is only at the bottom of those that don't have any other options. And part of the enrollment process would be screening people and making sure that they're directed to whatever other programs are currently available or to get the MnSure coverage if that's available to them.
Senator Nino.
And okay, so, and if I'm missing something, certainly enlighten me and correct me. But as I understand, so if I'm eligible to opt into the exchange, either state or federal, whatever the case might be, this would not cover me. My understanding is that everyone who is either a citizen of the United States or is here legally is eligible to do that. That would then leave only people that are here illegally. Am I missing something?
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, you're not missing anything at all. This is focused on those people who are here for whatever reasons. And the issue, of course, from the safety net provider community is that when they need health care, they need health care. And also from the federal and state government perspective, we do have a program that the federal government requires us to have to pay for the emergency and hospital and ER care when those people do, regardless of immigration status, when they have an emergency. So we're focusing for that group on can we spend that money better? Can we provide care before the hospital and after the hospital that prevents that revolving door, what we're seeing currently with those chronically ill people that end up back in the emergency room time and again because when they're discharged, they don't get the follow-up care for their heart condition or their diabetes or their psychiatric conditions. And so, again, the focus for that population is can we manage the chronic care better, and it's only available for those who have a serious condition that's likely to result in an emergency.
Senator Nino.
And then I guess this question probably be more for Senator Hayden as the author of the bill. I read through the bill, and I apologize if I missed it, but I didn't see anything in here that specified what kind of cost-sharing levels there would be for these individuals. I think the inference is that this would be either free or very low cost, but I just wanted to hear what is the intent of the author. I didn't see it specified in here.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Scandrett can kind of talk about the cost-sharing review. There is some cost-sharing.
Page 3, line 13 to 15, has the premiums and cost-sharing requirements of the Minnesota Care Program.
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I apologize. I was going back to my earlier line of questioning. I was just talking about the adults. This was for children.
Mr. Scandrett.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Nino, we are patterning this again after the emergency medical assistance, and it's people who are at 133% of poverty as opposed to the higher level, so the bill doesn't propose any co-pays or co-insurance for that population.
Senator Nino.
So just for my sake, I'm clear. So for adults, there would be no cost sharing.
Mr. Scandrett.
That's correct.
That's correct. All right. Any further questions?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 643 be passed and recommended to Finance.
Thank you. Before we vote on that, Senator Hayden, or would you consider? I'd like to have a further conversation about, you know, the what we're talking about here is that if you expend resources, we're expending resources now in the emergency medical system, and it's in expensive emergency room care, or when a illness receives a certain level. And the idea is if you do something earlier, you can have these cost savings again in the other part of the system. Is there a way we're going to have a look at that and make certain that our assumptions are valid?
Well, I'm most certainly open to do that. I know we're working closely with the department, and if this bill continues to move, we have to take a thorough look at that as we get to Senator Lori's committee.
Thank you. Seeing that, Senator Hayden renews his motion to pass Senate File. I got to look up our number here. 643 be passed and referred to Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam
Hayden.
Chair, members.
Thank you very much. Senator Saxhog is here. Thank you. Senator Saxog is here to present his bill on manufactured home space requirement modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today, as you say, I'm presenting file 209. This bill modernizes and clarifies the 1951 Minnesota Department of Health Manufactured Home Park Licensing Statute regarding vehicle parking limitations. And with me today is Mark Bruner from the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota to give a brief presentation and help answer any questions the committee might have. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name by introducing yourself and begin your testimony.
Sure. My name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. And as Senator Saxog said, what the bill does is update or modernize a 1951 statute that initially set the licensing requirements or standards for manufactured home parks in Minnesota. For the Department of Health, the Department of Health still does the licensing for manufactured home parks. There are about 900 manufactured home parks in the state of Minnesota, and essentially the issue is how close a resident can park their vehicle next to their home. The understanding had been for the past 65 years, and the Department of Health had gone ahead and had approved licenses and plans and that kind of thing to design a manufactured home park so that you could park your vehicle essentially next to your home. A new staff person came on board at the Department of Health a couple years ago, decided to take another approach in terms of how the statute was to be applied and interpreted. And what had happened was that the interpretation meant that you could no longer park your vehicle as the homeowner any less than 10 feet from your home. That was problematic in that, you know, the driveways were already in these manufactured home parks. And then what happened is a license was revoked in the city of Blaine. A 500 home site manufactured home park had its license suspended by the department under this new interpretation. The owner was told, well, in order to have your license renewed, you have a couple options. One is you could reconfigure the manufactured home park and have the driveways, if you will, relocated. They got an estimate on that. It was important that they continue to operate, and that would have been $2,000 per home site, or about $500,000, which wasn't the path they wanted to go down. Their other option was to eliminate the parking, have everyone park on the street, which was problematic for the Blaine Fire Department in terms of not being able to actually get to a home if there was a fire. So the license was revoked. The revocation went to an administrative law hearing late last year. The judge came back with her recommendation to the commissioner, which was that under the authority that the commissioner has, the judge recommended that a variance be granted, that the property continue to operate, and the judge did acknowledge, you know, you have the authority to do what you did, you have the authority to levy fines and that kind of thing. So what we have done is worked with the Department of Health as well as the resident organization, and the bill you have before you has their support, and it just simply clarifies that you can continue to do what you've been doing in terms of parking your vehicle next to your home. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Are there any questions from the committee on Senate File 209? Seeing none, Senator Rosen.
It seems like a very sensible bill, and so I would move that Senate File
209
be recommended to pass.
And move to the floor.
And move to the floor.
Is there any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much, Senator.
Madam Chair, members.
Okay, thank you very much. The next bill is Senator Benson's bill, Senate File 844. This bill is a cost-benefit approach to measure corrections and human services program success implementation. Senator Benson, and with Senator Benson is Kelly Harder, Dakota County Director of Human Services. of community services.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 844, I hope, will help us address a continual challenge. There are many requests and yet limited funds. I hope it also helps us address the ever-present promise that we would spend now and save later, that sometimes our intuition tells us that there is savings, but what we really need is a tool to help us make that decision. And so what I'm proposing, members, I gave you a lot of handouts because I knew this was going to be fast. I hope you have the time to peruse them should you send this bill forward. If you look at handout, I've labeled it number one, but it's the Pew MacArthur Results First Approach. Very straightforward, five steps, pretty high level, but clearly explains. There's a national database. The state adds and analyzes their own specific population and cost data. The model calculates long-term costs and benefits. It ranks the programs and then gives the information to policymakers for their budget processing. Beginning in the 1980s, Washington State, and again another handout, began the process. And for those of you who are looking at the visiting nurse program, you might pay special attention to the top of page 5. They inventory what they're spending in the programs they have in place. They evaluate them, prioritize them, develop accountability measures for outcomes, and they run them through established economic models over and over again to make sure they're accomplishing the goals that they set out. Since the inception of the Washington program, look at handout, the map. 17 states have started to adopt this process, and the Pew Charitable Trust with the MacArthur Foundation have adopted this as one of the services they provide in public policy. So consider, members, how this works. And again, I am sorry for rushing, but I want to be respectful of your time. Evidence-based policymaking. Specifically, if you look at page 4, there is a circle that outlines the steps that are taken: program assessment, budget development, implementation and oversight, outcome monitoring, and targeted evaluation. It's an iterative process so that we never stop looking for better ways to do things. It leverages on page 5 of that same handout. There's a growing bank of economic models that are used by Pew and other entities to help states complete this process. And then the final handout, and again, I hope you have a chance to read these in depth. Results First in Your State gives us the three specific things that we need to do. We commit to evidence-based decision making, we provide the relevant data, and we dedicate staff with statistical and fiscal skills in order to move this process forward. I'm going to let Mr. Harder give some details, some of the excitement around this and things that he has learned as he has done his research.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Kelly Harder. I'm the Community Services Director in Dakota County here on behalf of MICA as well, the counties. And thank you for allowing us the opportunity. What I would point you to is the one handout that you did have. That it was, there was a lot of handouts, so I encourage you, as if you don't get enough paper. But when you look at this one, and just take a brief moment, I believe the author and Senator Benson there referred you to page 5. You know, just imagine for a moment as policymakers, and really this is about having a universal tool, or said another way, a tool with enough universality across all the state departments, whether it's DOC, Human Services, they do some work in education, and they do work in other areas. And it's to come and to say, I always call it the fifth column on the balance sheet. That's figurative. There are more than five usually. But so often at the end of the day, you get many folks who come up in front of you and make really good pleas to why programs should be funded, and some of them should. But imagine having the tool that doesn't only look at the cost of the program, but it does also look at the community benefit of that program, and not just on a qualitative analysis level, but also the quantitative. This is not a one-size-fits-all tool, and it's not a silver bullet for everything. But there is a level of rigor that's in place that we in Minnesota, who I know we feel we're pretty good and pretty special, as we should, but there's also 14-plus other states who are implementing the very type of programs we have in the state that are quantified and go through the rigor. Just one of, for example, one of the formularies used, the mathematical formularies on one of the juvenile justice programs was a 90-page mathematical formulary. I'm not that, and I can't go to the validity, but what I can tell you is I've spoken to folks out in the state of Washington who've been in the Department of Human Service business, and they do use this often at the legislature. For nothing more, it puts Minnesota at the table with the other states who are learning from this, and how might they reinvest savings? How might they find in and make sure they're minimally investing in the right programs across the board? It is not an indictment that current return on investment and cost-benefit analyses aren't effective, that different departments are doing across the state. But it does give you a platform to think about how you do your work day in and day out, because there's never a question of, do you want to make good investments with taxpayer dollars? It's, are you making the most impactful, the ones that, that penetrate the furthest into the program? I can say on behalf of the counties, who also significantly subsidize and fund with local tax dollars a lot of these programs, we would find a significant amount of value for the state to also progress in this endeavor. We need a letter from the governor's administration, the leadership in the House and the Senate, in order to initiate Pew Institute, by which they come at no cost to us. They provide technical support. They provide the model that's used out at the Washington State Institute, and they also provide a tabletop for us to sit with others across the nation to provide the support. The legislation, however, does allocate dollars that would go to MMB in order to have dedicated staff as the liaison with Pew for implementation of this. And with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hardy. Any questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson and Mr. Harder, I really, really like the idea, and I wasn't familiar with what Pew and MacArthur are offering to us and so on, but one question I always have about this, I think we often talk about dynamic scoring of budget bills and so on, and I think we ought to be looking at ways of doing this, and I think in two areas you're looking at, corrections and human services, it makes sense. I'm wondering, though, sometimes when a group comes and tries to analyze something, they, well, we don't know what the impact of that would be, so we assume it's zero because we can't measure it. I can't tell from this, and I haven't read the things you've handed out. Is there a way, or do they try and say, hey, this number is very low certainty of whatever, but we think it does have something like that? I looked at the charts in there, but do they try and do best guesses instead, or do they kind of, we don't know how to measure that, so we kind of ignore that, which is sort of what I'd say we do in the state budget process now anyway.
Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, in order for a program to be evaluated with this level of rigor, it does have to have reached certain thresholds. So it is not for every program. And I think as policy decision makers, as I do back at my office, I often say to have a tool that is a that allows me priority setting, it's not a value judgment. But that's really hard, because how do you innovate and create new programs? You have to start from nothing at times. And so I think we also have to be careful as policymakers that this doesn't force everything into one model. But right now, what else do we have? And so minimally, what you see on that one handout, that's a pretty significant amount of programs and rigor. And I can tell you across the juvenile, a lot of the corrections and social service, Department of Human Service areas, Minnesota is already performing a significant amount of those programs. It's an issue of data access, and is the data prepared? And that's something Pew would do when they come in, is they do an inventory, they do an environmental scan, and they would make recommendations on what programs is Minnesota ready, most optimal to run through this rigor, and then they can bring it back, and then we can continue to build that out. I think for all of you, not only Pew, but think of creating on a social policy level in partnership with MMB, where you really do have that portfolio of return on investment modeling that's been completed across the country for programs that we want to do. And that allows you a deeper level of rigor when you're making those priority budget decisions.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is any of this prescriptive? I mean, if you have this certain outcome, is there any obligation by the state to follow through on that outcome?
Senator Benson or Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Eaton. This is a tool. It helps prioritize spending. It doesn't dictate spending. There isn't going to be a report coming from Pew that says you need to spend $4 billion of the human services budget in this area. That's not their job. Their job is for us to say we would like an analysis of early childhood programs, or in the case of human services, maybe mental illness. Many states have done corrections, and it's advice. It's best practices so that as we sit in our committees, we get flooded with bills and good ideas and touching stories, but how do we say this dollar spent here makes the longest, most valuable change in someone's life, and this is how it impacts our budget? It's supposed to be informative to us, not dictating to us.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that reassurance. This sounds like a good idea.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Benson, we've had several talks about this. My only concern, well, several years ago, members, we passed the pay for performance bill for basically measurements, benchmarks for programs to be paid at when they met their outcomes. And MMB has not been able to implement this program at all. And it is a real, this is in law. Pay for performance is in law. And we have nothing to show for it yet. So my question is, we are appropriating money to MMB here, and I'm hoping that it is something that they will take serious, as they should have with the pay for performance and the issuing of bonds. I think that was probably more of it. But also my question, Senator Benson, is about the standards or the implementation of the programs. How do you know the implementation oversight on the in the little round chart, ensure programs are effectively delivered. Is that governed by the Pew, or is that going to be set by MMB or the department that it's going through, that the program is going through? Who develops the oversight on that?
Do you want to try to answer that one? I would,
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, and I'm going to let my testifier speak to it, but in everything here that I have read, they talk about the legislature working with the executive branch. And so Mr. Harder probably knows more details on it, but we would have a role.
Mr. Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen. Results first in Pew. So first and foremost, I think it's important. Pew has no interest or desire to stay in any they have no governance oversight of this. Their motivation and goal actually was a result of so many states calling Washington State Institute because this seemed to make so much sense for the policymakers. So thanks to MacArthur funding, that's where Pew got involved. Their goal is to see this implementation across the country because they're seeing so much success of it, and provide that technical support in helping the state stand up. What the state would want ultimately for it to have success, you create these within the appropriate State Department. And by the way, this was heard in the House last week, and there's healthy conversation of where what State Department does this fit in, okay? That's fair. So there is no answer. That's really up to all of you. But once it is rolling, having dedicated staff person for implementation as that liaison with Pew, and then having the policy and technical work groups, and you all can set the rules about reporting back and having what role and proper oversight, that, as I understand, is uniquely it's unique in each state that takes this on.
And Senator Benson, but in your bill, you are determining that it's the Department of Human Services correction to evaluate corrections in human service programs. So that debate that you're talking about, Mr. Harder, about which division or which department would be tested with this is outside of corrections and human services. I mean, it's very specifically defined where we would focus this at this time.
Senator Madam Benson. Chair, the states that have shown the most success, if you do a search on Results First Pew, numerous videos, including those from legislators talking about the tool and how they used it. But most of them started with corrections because that's where it found its earliest success in Washington.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. To that end, they want to, for a state to commit the energy and the time to do this, they also want to see those early successes. And because the model is most matured in the corrections and human service space, that's where they also want to start. One last thing, they made a comment, and I actually just read it recently. It was like one of those aha moments, I should have known it, is in order to do any upstream front-end prevention work, one of the values is community benefit downstream. Well, one of the measures is, did they or did they not end up in incarceration? And you need to first have quantified that cost of if you do go to corrections, because once you get that figured out on the adult side, then for any other program that you're assessing, and one of the factors is that without the intervention they would end up in corrections, then you already have that formulary completed. So it has such good application over so many programs as you get into adolescent, Department of Human Services, Children's Mental Health, you get into juvenile corrections. You are ultimately always going to have to end up knowing what that true cost is. So it starts in corrections in human services because it's where they direct and know what states have had the first success in. You can see by the handout there are other areas they do their work in. The thought to the authors was, let's start where we can have the most success and continue to build off of that.
Senator Nelson, then Senator Marty, and we're coming down on our time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson, I find this a very intriguing concept, and there's a lot of things here that I think are really worthy of furthering. One thing we often do here is we recognize the problems, and bill after bill comes before us trying to solve a problem. But so oftentimes, we don't know a year later or 2 years later if those programs worked. So I particularly like the fact that this is a very data-driven solution. And I can envision this along Senator Marty's lines. I've often talked about dynamic scoring and how we're missing that when we look at appropriating money and what does it save downstream. We never actually get to look at that. And so I see this as a real possibility to further make our fiscal notes do a better, better inform us as to what the economic tangibles are for the policies that are before us. And anyone who knows anything about the Pew Foundation knows that it is data rich. Mm-hmm. It has more data about individual states and individual incidents and projects in that state than probably anywhere else that I have found. So the fact that this is very data-rich, data-driven, I see that there's a great possibility here for us to start making evidence-based decisions. And I see this as maybe like a pilot in those areas where there's been the greatest success. But I would also add that it might be valuable as we evaluate or reevaluate those programs that are currently in our budget. So I think there's a lot of possibilities here, and I want to encourage you because I think it's going to help us determine what's working, which is the question that most Minnesotans have, what's working.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I really like this idea. I would distinguish getting information, how we decide which direction to go and so on, from overkill on data, where we spend so much time evaluating we don't spend the time doing. But I think this is a key thing. I think like in the child protection issue that's coming up that both Senator Rosen and the chair have worked on, I think most of us recognize by intervening quickly with those, fully investigating, making sure something's done with it, it actually saves us a ton of money in corrections and other things later. So I think this is a spot on the way to do how this one Pew project helps with that. I'm not sure, but I think it's certainly a step in the right direction.
Would you like to make a motion, Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 844 be referred to, I believe, the Committee on Finance as its next stop.
Yes. The motion is to pass 844 and refer to Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much, Senator Benson.
Madam
and
Chair,
that, thank you very much. And that concludes the business for today. We are adjourned.